Thank you, Jürgen, for that generous and warm introduction. Thanks to Bernd Scherer and his wonderful colleagues at the house for the not just the invitation, but the wonderful hospitality that we've been enjoying over the last several days. Thanks to my colleagues at the conference, from whose presentations I've learned a lot, who have fundamentally made me rethink the title of this presentation. So when the title was decided was, of course, when I had been invited to the conference. And while I still warmly respond to the invitation of the conference organizers, what I'm going to do in the talk is to be very rude to Anthropocene and decline its invitation. And I'll begin by explaining why I have to decline the invitation of Anthropocene and still talk about anthropogenic global warming and climate change and what it means for history. So what we've learned in this conference is that as a specific geological concept, the Anthropocene is still in the process of being sorted out, being proven, being accepted at one level. And therefore, one can't yet treat it as the official name of a geological period. So the debate about whether we're still in the Holocene or we've entered the Anthropocene is still open. On the other hand, we've also learned that the word Anthropocene has taken on a kind of rhetorical power where it can be equated broadly with different ideas which can be brought under the rubric of the age of humans. And in that sense, one could say Anthropocene began with the killing of the big mammals. We can't quite be sure in that sense where exactly Anthropocene began. So I will actually begin with the problem that originally got me into this field, which is a much reduced claim and a smaller claim, but a more specific claim that, and which is there in the geological thinking behind Anthropocene, which is that collectively, human beings now, thanks to their profligate use of fossil fuel, act with the power of a geophysical force. And I'm not claiming human beings are the only geophysical force. I'm not claiming they are the most important geophysical force, but they definitely act with the power of a geophysical force. That is, with the power that would normally belong to some enormous geophysical agency, such as shifts in tectonic plates, or major volcanic eruptions, or a strike by an asteroid to determine the climate of the planet as a whole, to influence the planetary system. The reason why I got interested in this proposition initially was, of course, from the fact of being a historian. You know, history for the last several centuries, and surely very intensively, in the last 50 or 60 years since the war, has celebrated the idea of human freedom. Not just history, if you think of Professor Amartya Sen's book, Development is Freedom. The central concept is freedom. And as a historian, one can't think of the availability of cheap energy in the form of fossil fuels without kind of, as a human being, gratefully thinking about the role that fossil fuels played in liberating us from the obligation to use massive bodies of forced labor in order to build monumental structures. So the irony was fascinating that the same fossil fuels that we could have once welcomed as the agency that helped us to liberate ourselves from forced labor was now being seen as the instrument through which we've acquired the agency of a geophysical force. And I must say again that coming from India, the sense of irony is very important, I think, to Indian sense of modern history because, you know, before the British came, we had quite developed theories of enjoyment, basically theories of bodily fluids that create moods in enjoyment. And depending on how you count them, we used to think of as there being 8 or 9 such moods of enjoyment. We call them rasa, which literally means juices. That's at the basis of Indian medical thinking, Hindu medical thinking, as well as at the basis of our systems of rhetoric. And things like, the mood of peace, the mood of finding something sweet, the mood of finding something grotesque. That's how the list goes. I always thought that European colonial rule gave us the 9th or the 10th rasa, which was the rasa of irony. In other words, to look at human history, mainly to see how the shadow falls between the promise and the performance. So the shadow of Anthropocene has now fallen, or the human beings becoming a geophysical agency, has now fallen between the promise of freedom and the actual achievement of it. So you can see the twist that that it has to be one of the profoundest ironies of our modern history that increasing use of such energy should have now transformed our collective image in our own eyes from that of an autonomous, if not sovereign, and purposeful agency from the level of the individuals to level of groups, to that of a force which is defined as the sheer capacity to produce pull or push on an object by interacting it merely as another object. In other words, when we say we are acting like a force, we say we don't have any sovereignty, we are like another object. A geophysical force has no sense of purpose or sovereignty. So humans have clearly embroiled themselves in histories which really shouldn't be any business of their own, histories that are much larger than their own, interfering with the glacial, interglacial cycle of the Earth is probably a lot more than what the pioneers of fossil fuel energy bargained for. And this very sense of irony is expressed when, in his book Storms from My Grandchildren, the famous NASA scientist James Hansen calls anthropogenic global warming the Faustian bargain, humanity's own trap. So the climate crisis brings into view the collision or the running up against one another of three histories that are normally assumed to be working at such different and distinct paces that they're treated as processes separate from one another for all practical purposes. So these are the history of the Earth system, history of life, including that of human evolution on the planet, and the more recent history of the industrial way of life, for many, capitalism. Humans now straddle the three histories that operate on very different scales and at very different speeds. Now, here I have to say that the advantage of staying with the reduced theme of climate change and anthropogenic global warming, rather than the much larger question of the Anthropocene as the age of the humans, is that the question of global warming has a logic of causality which intrinsically, not historically, historically it could get connected, but which logically is indifferent to the question of injustice between humans. You can imagine a very just human society throughout the planet. About a society about which, let's say, we have no complaints. Let's say, the Bolshevik revolution had succeeded and Trotsky had succeeded, and an international revolution had taken place, every country was socialist. But imagine that a socially just world still being dependent on fossil fuel. The climate crisis would have been worse, because the only reason why we haven't put out more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere than we already have is because most people are poor. Most of the emitting is done by 1/5 of humanity, by 12 or 14 nations, including India and China. So in a way, you can see that while it is contingently and historically true that the climate crisis has happened when we are in a fossil fuel-based, largely capitalist structure, and therefore the climate crisis will accentuate the inequities of capitalism, which itself will have very interesting implications for the kind of debates we have about climate change and how we propose to address the problem. Logically and intrinsically, the more defined problem of anthropogenic global warming, as distinct from the age of humans, logically and intrinsically, it is blind to the question of justice between human beings. So that, as I said, even a very just society based on fossil fuel could have actually produced a much larger crisis than we already have. So in that sense, I do not see anthropogenic global warming in a line of continuity with either the kind of environmental histories we were writing or the history of capitalism. So that it is not, in my framework, just yet another instance of the truths that I already knew about the world. That's why I found it interesting. It was challenging. There's a sentence in one of Heidegger's texts which I always remember in a distorted fashion in my head. So I'll quote the distorted sentence because I find it useful, the distorted version of it. But I remember Heidegger as saying, "It is very hard to hear that which I do not already understand." And if there's got to be something new about the climate crisis, there has to be something in it that I do not already understand. And what was exciting for me was the obvious fact that I knew nothing about the history of the planet and life on it. I'm not a biologist. I knew nothing about the history of Earth systems. I knew something about the history of capitalism. I knew something about the last 500 years of human history. And I found that my framework wasn't enough. So that's why I think of it as a coming together, a conjuncture, when suddenly our capacity to change the atmosphere has hit these three histories with such force that it suddenly opens up a moment when these three histories working together. The history of the planetary system, the history of life on this planet, and our very human, small-scale history, which is broadly history of injustice at the moment and inequities of capitalism. Humans have interfered with the glacial-interglacial cycle of the planet, which normally completes itself over 130 years or so, so much so that we have effectively put off the new ice age, the next ice age, or deferred it, says Kurt Sager, in his book Deep Future. The paleoclimatologist David Archer explains that we do not know what impact this could have on the planet's thermostat, the carbon cycle. So in the moment you begin to read about the science of climate change, these are the two cycles you have to think about. One is the critical one of the interglacial-interglacial cycle. Many people have mentioned that the Holocene was an interglacial, that is between two ice ages. And then there's a much larger carbon cycle of the planet, which takes millions of years to complete. Everybody says that however much greenhouse gas we might put out in the atmosphere, the carbon cycle will take it out and balance the carbon of the planet, the carbon exhalation and inhalation of the planet, but that will take over a million years. But in the meanwhile, we don't know, at least Archer says, what the relationship is between the shorter cycle and the longer cycle. And his hunch is that the longer cycle gets amplified by the shorter cycle gets amplified by the longer cycle. But the carbon cycle is really the history of the Earth having no ice at all, the hothouse condition, no polar ice, and the ice house condition, which is having polar ice. So even though there's global warming happening, it sounds paradoxical, we're actually in the ice house condition of the planet in terms of the carbon cycle. Paleoclimatologists actually tell a very long history when it comes to explaining the significance of anthropogenic global warming. There is, first of all, the question of evidence. Now, Will Stephen has already talked about the samples of ancient air, more than 600,000 years old, how that has been critical in establishing the anthropogenic nature of the current warming. There are, besides the paleoclimatic records of the past, in fossils and other geological materials. The geologist cum oil industry advisor, Brian Lovell, has written a very lucid book on the oil industry's response, and interestingly, not always negative or not uniformly negative, and even the differences between BP and Exxon are fascinating on the question of how they would respond to the crisis. But Lovell actually says that the group within the industry that supplied the industry with compelling evidence of the serious challenge that the greenhouse gas emissions posed to the health of the planet were the geologists who could reap deep climate histories buried in sedimentary rocks to see the effect of a dramatic warming event that took place 55 million years ago, which in the literature is called the Pleistocene-Eocene thermal maximum. Jan has talked a little bit about it. And he writes, comparison of the volume of carbon released to the atmosphere then and the volume we are releasing ourselves strongly suggests that we are indeed facing a major global challenge. We are in the danger of repeating that 55-million-year-old global warming event which disrupted Earth over 100,000 years. And the event took place long before Homo sapiens were around to light so much as a campfire. How far the arc of this geological history explaining the present climate crisis projects into the future may be quickly seen from the very subtitle of David Archer's book, where the subtitle is How Humans Are Changing the Next 100,000 Years of Earth's Climate. Mankind, writes Archer, is becoming a force in climate comparable to the orbital variations, the Milankovitch effect, that drive glacial cycles. The long lifetime, he writes, of fossil fuel CO2 creates a sense of fleeting folly about the use of fossil fuels as an energy source. Our fossil fuel deposits, 100 million years old, could be gone in a few centuries, leaving climate impacts that will last for hundreds of millennia. The lifetime of fossil fuel CO2 in the atmosphere is a few centuries, plus he talks about this long tail that essentially lasts forever. The carbon cycle, as I said, then it will eventually clean it up, but we are kind of playing with the thermostat of the planet without knowing the consequences. And what I find interesting in Archer's book is that he actually goes to the heart of the problem here, that when you're dealing with such vast scales, what do you do in terms of either activism or policy? He goes to that problem saying that the million-year timescale of the planet's carbon cycle, and I'm quoting him, is irrelevant for political considerations of climate change on human timescales. Yet, he insists, it remains relevant to any understanding of anthropogenic climate change, since ultimately global warming will last for as long as it takes these slow processes to act. So we are now confronted with these slow processes which we can't hasten up. Events on such very large scale, as I said, do not lend themselves to policy making or activism. But climate change is here, it has happened, and it's not a one-off problem like the hole in the ozone layer that we're going to solve through some brilliant technical ingenuity. Practical questions concern issues of mitigation of the impacts of climate change and adjusting to them. The price will be several small and big tragedies. We're in a situation that civilized humans have never had to confront before. So though this is not the first instance of climate change that humans have encountered in their past. So we have to, in this situation, what I'm going to talk about, having declined Anthropocene's invitation, as you can see, but accepted the invitation of climate change and anthropogenic global warming, what I'm going to talk about is the way in which this crisis seems to me to be opening up what I would call three kind of rifts in our thinking. And by rifts, I mean they're creating openings which are like tears on a surface. And I don't mean an either-or structure. I mean, by a rift, I mean we are working on both sides of the rift. And that is what our dilemma issues from. So it's in Derridean terms, you can think of it as a structure of supplementarity. So we do not overcome the dilemmas that I'm going to talk about, the three dilemmas, but they remain as rifts. And in the rest of the lecture, I'll organize this. Okay. So the first rift is really the rift between risk and uncertainty. And very simply put, risk is uncertainty you can broadly measure by assigning probability values to the uncertainty. So actually, when you think of something as risk, you basically reduce the uncertainty. And uncertainty is what you can't measure in terms of probability. I mean, these were discussed by a Chicago, very well-known Chicago economist, Frank Knight, in a book called risks, uncertainty and profit, but others have discussed them too. Modern life under capitalism is ruled by regimes of probabilistic thinking. From evaluating lives for actuarial ends, insurance, pension payments, to the working of money and stock markets, we manage our societies by calculating risks and assigning probability values to them. This is surely one reason why economics as a discipline has emerged as the major art of social management today, and I very consciously call it an art and not a science. There is therefore an understandable tendency in both climate justice and climate policy literature, the latter dominated by economists, to focus not so much on what paleoclimatologists or geophysicists who study planetary climate historically have to say about climate change, but rather on what we might call the physics of climate science that often presents a predictable static relationship of probability and proportion. If the share of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere goes up by X, then the probability of the Earth's average surface temperature going up by so much is Y. That's the kind of structure of argument you begin to get. Such a way of thinking assumes a kind of stability or predictability, however probabilistic it may be, on the part of a warming atmosphere that paleoclimatologists, to my reading, do not always assume. This is not because policy thinkers are not concerned about the dangers of climate change. They clearly are. And their analyses are clearly instructive insofar as they go. But in their analysis, even when they write for the lay audience, they appear to hold or bracket climate change, that is the agency of the climate, as a broadly known variable, converting its uncertainties into risks that have been acknowledged and evaluated, while working out options that humans can create for themselves, striving or even wrangling together. The world climate system, in other words, is not an active agent in their frameworks. It is there to be managed by human ingenuity, political mobilization, and by mathematical calculation. And what I found interesting in reading paleoclimatologists alongside economists is that in the rhetoric of the climate scientists, and this is reading them as a from a humanist point of view, being with an interest in rhetoric, what I find is that in what they write to persuade the public, the images that they draw of the climate are often remarkably vitalist or full of organicist metaphors. There's not only the famous case of the British geochemist James Lovelock comparing the life system of the planet to a single living organism that he christened Gaia, a point that even the sober paleoclimatologist David Archer accommodates in his primer on the global carbon cycle as a fair but philosophical definition. Archer himself describes the climate cycle of the Earth as alive. The image of climate as a temperamental animal also inhabits the language of the environmental scientist Wallace Brooker from Columbia University, who in a book co-authored with Robert Kunzig thus describes his own studies of climate. And this is Wally Brooker writing. Every now and then, nature has decided to give a good swift kick to the climate beast. That's how he's describing climate change. And the beast has responded, as beasts will. So climate has the nature of a beast. Violently and a little unpredictably. It's the temperamental nature of the climate beast. Computer models are certainly a valid approach, but studying how the beast has responded in the past, that is actually a historical argument, study the history of the climate, not just depend on computer models. Computer models are certainly a valid approach, but studying how the beast has responded in the past under stress is another way to prepare ourselves for what might happen as we take a whack at it ourselves. And that's the idea that has obsessed me for the past 25 years. And with each passing year, it has seemed more urgent. Or notice James Hansen, how he uses the word lethargy in explaining climate change in his book that I mentioned before. He says, the speed of glacial interglacial change is dictated by 20,000, 40,000, or 100,000 time scales for changes of Earth's orbit. But this does not mean that climate change is inherently that lethargic. On the contrary, human-made climate forcing by paleoclimatic standards is large, and changes in decades not tens of thousands of years, as happened during the thermal maximum I talked about. The vitalism of this prose clearly comes from the climate scientist's anxiousness to communicate and underscore two points about the Earth's climate. That is, its too many uncertainties cannot ever be completely tamed by existing human knowledge, and therefore the inherent unpredictability of its exact tipping point. And as David Archer puts it, the IPCC forecast for climate change in the coming century is for a generally smooth increase in temperature. However, actual climate changes in the past have tended to be abrupt. Climate models, for the most part, are unable to simulate the flip-flops in the past climate record very well. It is, in fact, this sense of a climate beast that is missing from both the literature inspired by economics and sometimes also from that inspired by political commitments on the left. The moral philosopher John Broome, a leading author of the Working Group 3 of IPCC 2007 report, and himself an economist turned philosopher, looks forward to a future where he thinks climate models will continually improve to narrow the probabilities that should be assigned to various possibilities. So in a way, living with uncertainty means you live with a possibility. And you don't know. I mean, like, you know that your house could go up in fire anytime. It's a possible thing. So sometimes you buy a fire extinguisher or you buy a fire insurance, but the possibility seems slim, so you actually can put a probability value on it. Here, the tipping point is a possibility you're living with without being able to put a probability value on it. But Broome says that for economic reasoning to have a better grasp of the world, detailed information about probabilities are needed, and therefore, he says, we are waiting for it to be supplied by the scientists. Right? So this is in spite of the way that scientists are describing the climate beast. There's this expectation that for economics to continue. So there's no question of economists actually thinking, should we rethink our subject? Right? But thinking, okay, once we get the data, our operations will carry on. But this may be to misunderstand the nature of the planet's climate and that of the models that humans make of it. Climate uncertainties may not always be like measurable risks. Do we really need to know? Asked Paul Edwards rhetorically in his book on the history of climate models, A Vast Machine. Do we really need to know more than we know now about how much the Earth will warm? Can we know more? And he actually goes on to develop an argument that how difficult it might be to develop a climate model that actually predicts that tipping point. And then he says, I'll just end this section with Paul Edwards. He says, just as with human history, and I'm, as a historian, I'm fascinated by this opening to history of a different kind in the argument. Just as with human history, we will never get a single unshakable narrative of the global. Just as in human history, we will never get a single unshakable narrative of the global climate's past. Instead, we get different versions of the atmosphere, convergent, but yet never identical. Moreover, all of today's analyses are based on climate we have experienced in historical time. And he quotes two scientists, Miles Allen and David Frame, as saying, once the world has warmed by 4 degrees Celsius, now this gets back to the tipping point discussion that Bill Steffen was presenting in his lecture, conditions will be so different from anything we can observe today that, and still more different from the last ice age, that it is inherently hard to say when the warming will stop. So, as you can see, talking about risk versus uncertainty, I'm saying this is the first history that opens up, which is the history of the climate system, which is part of the much longer geological history of the planet. Now I go on to my second rift, which I call our divided human lives and our shared history as a dominant species. Now my argument here, and I'll skip over large parts of it in the interest of time, human beings, I don't think will ever make a single operative political unity. There's a lot of idealism and goodwill in asking what should we all do. In whatever is your answer, and whatever the goodwill supporting that answer, backing it up, that answer will be subject to human wrangling, to human disputation, to human arguments, strong disagreements, violent disagreements, small tragedies, big tragedies. I don't think, now I go back to the historical connection, not the in-principle connection between climate change and the injustices we are part of. And in that, it is out of that position that sometimes completely understandable demand for justice and equity in the climate crisis, but sometimes theoretical points are made from which I disagree. That was the point of, in other words, when people say climate crisis has been brought about by inequality, when people say climate crisis is reflective essentially of economic inequality, and this has been said from 1991 to recent textbooks, to UN reports, that it's the uneven development, that's the problem behind climate crisis, I think we misunderstand the causal model of climate crisis. That's why I said initially that even a just society using fossil fuel could have produced even a larger climate crisis. But historically, there's a lot to be said in support of the argument. It is out of this kind of argument in 1991 that two Indian environmental activists and thinkers, Sunita Agarwal, who's still alive, and Sunita Narayan and Anil Agarwal, published a pamphlet which became the basis of the whole per capita emissions approach in 1991, which was called Environmental Global Warming, Environmental Colonialism. And this was an argument against, a third worldist argument against first worldist one worldism. They saw this tendency to say it's humanity's problem as people using the word humanity as a fig leaf with which to cover the self-interest of the predatory first world nations. And out of that came, based on a principle of equality, the idea that emissions must be calculated on a per capita basis. There are all kinds of arguments one can get into about that. Interestingly, recently, just last year, a book came out from India called Handbook of India and Climate Change, in which an Indian scientist actually writes that India's approach to climate crisis from early on has been informed more by political science than by climate science. In other words, the historical relationship to the West, of seeing the West as predatory, has determined more of these positions than actual knowledge of climate science, which is why the position has been recently shifting within India. But I want to, show to you is that even in the per capita figure, there is an interesting problem hidden there, which needs to be discussed, which is the question of population. As the Indian minister, Jairam Ramesh, the environment minister, once said in the parliament in 2009, he said, look, we make so much of the per capita emissions figure, but if we had succeeded in solving poverty and controlling our population, we wouldn't have been able to make this claim. We are, in a sense, making a virtue of, what is it, two of our failures. But that's not the argument. The argument, what I'm trying to make is that the problem of population gets both acknowledged and disavowed in the per capita figures that often underlie the arguments for climate justice. And the reason I'm saying is this, because I think population remains a very important factor in how the climate crisis plays out. Without India and China's population being so large and so poor, their per capita figures of emissions would have not have been so low. But without their having had such large populations, and the governments legitimately desiring to pull them out of poverty, they would not have been building so many coal-fired power stations every year. And coal is still the cheapest fuel. I mean, when I listen to discussions on coal on Indian television and the media, there's no discussion about climate change. There's a discussion about the advantage of using cheap coal. The Indian government is fond of quoting Gandhi on environmental crisis. They're fond of quoting Gandhi on any situation. Not just the environmental crisis, but the Indian white paper on climate crisis begins by saying, as Mahatma Gandhi said, this is what we always say. We don't do what he said, but we say what he said. So we quote him saying, there is enough in the world for everybody's need, but not enough for everybody's greed. Yet, greed and need become indistinguishable from each other in arguments used in defense of continued use of coal, the worst offender among fossil fuels. It is still the cheapest source of fuel. In 2011, reports the New York Times, coal represented 30% of the world's energy. That was the highest share the coal had had since 1969. Coal use was expected to increase by 50% by 2035, bringing enormous opportunities to companies in South America. And that's why American coal companies are lobbying the government that, okay, fine, you ban coal domestically, but why shouldn't we export coal to India and China to help them deal with poverty? And that's why I'm saying how the need and the greed sort of come together in this coal argument. But more importantly, see how the population question brings to view a much larger history, which is, as I said, history of life on the planet and history of human evolution. Population going forward is a problem, not just because of what it does to climate emissions, but what it means for climate impact of climate change. The total size and distribution of humanity matters in how the climate crisis unfolds. Now, human distribution over the planet happened long before capitalism. The last place to be settled by humans were the Pacific Islands. And that happened about 4,000 years ago. It was completed. So long before capitalism, human growth has been in the last 200 years. But the distribution happened, and that's part of human evolution. There is the widely accepted point that humanity has been putting pressure on other species quite some time now. I do not need to belabor it. Indeed, the war between animals and humans can be seen every day in many Indian cities and villages. And ocean acidification, which follows from climate change, will only aggravate that problem. But the reason why the history of human evolution gets in the way of species survival, there is another reason why the history of human evolution actually gets in the way of species survival as the planet warms. One way that species threatened by global warming will try to survive is by migrating to areas more conducive to their existence. This is how they have survived past changes in the climatic conditions of the planet. But now there are so many of us, and we are so widespread on this planet, that humans actually stand in the way of species migrating to other places. The more tragic thing is, human groups, particular human groups, stand in the way of other human groups migrating because of climate change. So actually, our evolutionary history will have an impact on the climate refugee problem and its seriousness. The history of population thus belongs to two histories at once: the very short-term history of the industrial way of life and modern medicine and technology that enabled us to multiply, and the much, much longer-term deep history of our species, the history through which we have evolved to be the dominant species of the planet, spreading all over it and now threatening the existence of many other life forms. And the poor, I submit, participate in that shared history of human evolution, however differently from the rich do. But the poor participate and partake of it just as much as the rich do. No individual human member of the species actually is exempt from being influenced by the history of our evolution. So the per capita emission figures, while useful in making a necessary and corrective political point in the debates on climate change, hides the larger history that population is clearly a category that conjoins, again, two different histories together. My last rift that I want to talk about is wrestling with forms and histories of anthropocentrism, of anthropocentric, not just thinking, practice. Now, here again, I want to begin quickly with one irony. When Will Steffen was showing all those very convincing graphs about the great acceleration, 1950s, think of what was happening in the world. Consumer durables were being sold. Washing machines were coming into American households saying women are getting liberated. Decolonization was happening. Third world countries were adopting development programs like the dams that Akhil was referring to. That great acceleration actually includes, since globalization, a certain kind of democracy of consumption. Harvard is just going to publish a book on the history of cell phones in India. It's a combination of economic study and anthropology. And you have to go to India and China and to see how proud people are of their cell phones. These days, most people use iPhones. Or smartphones, not iPhones, but smartphones. And the things even that illiterate people do on them. So in a way, while the great acceleration is part of the crisis, that crisis also experienced at a human level in our small human history as democratization. A lot of it, not everything about it. And partly, you have to remember that while electoral democracy has not spread throughout the world, democracy of consumption is a major way in which governments try to legitimize themselves, even authoritarian governments. And to begin with that irony then, I want to say, like Zizek used to say, old Zizek, whom I loved, new Zizek criticizes me, so can't love him as much. But Zizek made a wonderful point in his early work on ideology, that ideology is not just to do with thoughts. You know, we were discussing how do we get out of anthropocentrism. Now, we don't get out of anthropocentrism by spending a weekend of vipassana, or which is sort of silent meditation, or spending a weekend with a tea group, telling each other, saying, hey, that's anthropocentric thought, must not think this way. But then you go and do everything that you do. You actually remain within the structures of anthropocentrism. There's a larger argument that I'm working on in my head, which is actually about how late capitalism itself is anthropocentric and grounds us in anthropocentric thinking. But at the same time, there is a question of thought also. So what I'll do is give you two examples of what I think of as anthropocentric thoughts. And the reason why I have it in plural, forms and histories, is because I don't think anthropocentric thought is indifferent to historical changes. And so there are different forms, so there are continuities. One of the points I was making during our discussions in this conference is that it seems to me that even religions that come after the agricultural revolution produce a certain view of man's relationship to nature that seems more man-centered than the kind of stories that Beth Povinelli was telling us in her lecture, Cipel. There's a fascinating story I was sharing with Beth, that last year I was marking an Australian PhD thesis, and I'll tell you very briefly the story, because it's very interesting. It was about when Indians went to Australia as camel drivers in the 19th century. They were all called Afghans, no reason. They were not all Afghans, but they were called Afghans, anyway. And there was a point in Western Australia where Aboriginal tracks happened to be because there was a water body. And on that water body, there were myths about the red clay that you could find there. There was a story that the dingo dog ate the emu bird at that point, and the blood of the emu got into the soil and made it red. And that had given certain properties to the water, so the Aboriginals used to come here. So because every path followed older paths, then the camel track followed the old Aboriginal track, and eventually the trains came in the 1860s, and the railway track followed the camel track. And one day, two Aboriginal girls, young girls in their teens, were waiting in the 1860s for the train, and the train was late. In the meanwhile, two heavy-looking Indian Afghan came on camels, and finding these teenage girls there, they said to them, they stopped, and the girls were scared, and they said to them, show us your breasts. And out of fear, the girls showed them their breasts, thinking that they were going to sexually molest them. And then the Afghan said, now show us your thighs. And the girls got really scared, because they thought, these men must want to eat us. And it's fascinating how Aboriginal stories, religious stories or myth-making stories, being eaten, being raped, blood being shed, there's no sense of this man facing a world in which God has left him provisions. So the example I'll give purely comes out of my accident of my reading. It comes out of reading a very famous commentator on Islam who used to teach at the University of Chicago, Fazlur Rahman, has a very interesting book on the Quran. And in the chapter, in the third chapter, where he's discussing why in the Quran, in explaining God, they use two words. One is Arabic words. One is Qadr, meaning both power and measuring out. And the other one is Amar, meaning command that God expresses. And I'll just read out one paragraph where it says, the all-powerful, purposeful, and merciful God measured out everything, bestowing upon everything the right range of potentialities. his laws of behavior, in some its character. This measuring out, qadar, on the one hand ensures the orderliness of nature, on the other expresses the most fundamental, unbridgeable difference between the nature of God and the nature of man. The Creator's measuring implies an infinitude which no measured creature can share. So this is why nature cannot disobey God. And in the same token, it enjoins very clearly, man cannot play God. Unlike Mark Linus's God Species, that man cannot play God. But Rahman clarifies, therefore, that man cannot discover the laws, but what man can do, he says, can discover God's laws and exploit it for human benefit. And that's why God is merciful. That's one reason. You know, even though nature follows God's order, I can work out the order and use it for, and he uses the English word exploit, it for my benefit. We get the same thought in secular and unvarnished prose in the Oxford moral philosopher John Broome, whom I've quoted in his book on Ethics in a Warming World, where he says, what is ultimately good? Because he thinks that climate change raises this question. What is ultimately good? And he says, that question is too big for his book, and still proceeds to offer these thoughts on the value of nature. He says, nature is undoubtedly valuable because it is good for people. It provides material goods and services. The river brings us clean water and takes away our dirty water. Wonderful. She has to quote, look at Ganges. Wild plants provide many of our medicines. Nature also brings emotional good to people. But the significant question raised by climate change is whether nature has value in itself. This question is too big for this book. I shall concentrate on the good of the people. It's another example of economic thought shying away from the brink of that externality which you cannot manage. Right? Broome acknowledges that climate change raises the question of the value of nature, apart from what it does for man, but considers it too big for a book on ethics in a warming planet. For his ethics are all about human welfare. He may have unnecessarily cut short in his line of thinking. In fact, the most difficult sentence, most challenging sentence I've read on this whole question of how to think about health and of the planet or the system is actually in James Lovelock's book, The Vanishing Face of Gaia, where he uses it almost as his motto. He says, to consider the health of the earth, if you want to consider the health of the earth, then he says, consider it without the constraint that the welfare of humankind comes first. Now that's damn difficult to do. You say, what good is having an earth in which humans are not there? But actually his reasoning is not as bad as you might think. He actually says, humans have to understand that only if we can think of the health of the planet without putting ourselves first, that we ensure our own well-being. That's the argument. And that's why he would say that Broome should have thought about the fundamental question about the value of nature. And that, I think, is approaching the borders of non-anthropocentric forms of thinking. So what would it mean to think of the health of the planet without putting human welfare first? One aspect of it would be, it seems to me, to be always aware in our worldly thoughts of the relationship between the history of the earth and that of life on it, and that we arrive very late in that history. The idea of a living earth, writes the geologist Doug McDougall, referring to Henry David Thoreau's Walden, is metaphoric. We do not have a living earth exactly, but one whose paths continually interact. More than that, organic life, once formed, becomes a fundamental determinant of the non-organic life. Bacterial work contributes to the carbon cycle. Even mineral formation is biologically mediated. Once, McDougall writes, once you have plants, photosynthesizing plants, and oxygen is in the air, there's oxygenation process by which you get much larger range of minerals than the planet originally had. So humans are outscaled by the climate crisis. Coping with it intellectually, politically, must mean coping with the problem of scale that exists across the very many histories in which we suddenly find ourselves. The larger we, that larger we, will not make us politically one. And it is precisely because we are not politically one that histories of intra-human injustice and welfare will remain relevant and necessary. But even as we engage in those battles, we'll probably have to think of them in the much larger context of the history of life, how Earth history connects to it, and where humans figure in it overall. Thank you very, very much.